Well, my name is Vern Reiki, Lou Vern, actually, but my folks can't account for that. I'm doing a five-session series springing out of the theme for this summer at Holden on gentle justice. And I'll be telling you in just a moment about some of the things that we'll be talking about this week if you like to play these kinds of games. Why didn't the United States accept the decision of the World Court with reference to the claims of Nicaragua? I don't want to know whether or not you think the World Court was right or wrong or indifferent. I want to know why we didn't accept that decision.
Asking us this now, mm-hmm. Maybe I can ask you a question. Have we ever accepted?
Yes. Okay. When we were the plaintiff and won.
And we stated in advance that we would not accept, when we were still just barely coming to trial, we stated in advance that we would not accept it because we didn't.
So we didn't agree to having that matter put to the World Court of Justice. Yes, sir.
The other thing is it's possible that our intelligence sources have our privy to information, which, of course, this is our standard cop-out, that we don't know about, and there's things that we know about, that they know about.
Yes. We might have thought that it would be a very bad decision from our point of view. Do we normally get to say to a court, I don't want to be sued, and therefore I will not recognize the decision which you are about to make? No, the answer to that is obviously usually not.
We have that option when the court has no power to enforce its rules.
Aha. Uh-huh. I was looking for that word power. What does it mean? You used it first.
In this case, the court is making a judgment call, and that is all you can say for that decision from a court standpoint.
But you think that the point is that they didn't have the power to enforce it?
Yes, I think so.
Those that have the power don't have to abide by the rules.
Might makes right. Now, the last hour, for those of you who were attending Ruth's study of Genesis, heard it said that one of the things that some theologians believe might be indicated by that first chapter in Genesis is that God intended to create a world without violence. Mr. Justice Holmes once said that law exists only in a policeman's nightstick. Anything that you can't enforce is not law. Well, that's enough for openers. My goal this morning is to get your brains thoroughly scrambled, at least moving. I would like during the week to talk about five legal, and I'm going to put a line under that, Christian concepts. Words, ideas, notions, theories. We have to find some way of learning to live together in this world. It's simply true that we cannot resort to violence every time we disagree with someone. One of my heroes in the Second World War, I will tell only one more story, then I won't do that again. A man of whom I was very fond, was a lieutenant by the name of White. And during one particular bit of unpleasantness over a piece of land, island actually, the reporters who were doing life impressions, I was always relieved to see somebody who reassured us we were still alive, came up with the we have four runners in the village. The forerunner of a tape recorder, a very primitive machine indeed, and stuck it up under his nose and said, "Lieutenant White, what do you think of this bloodshed that you see going on around you?" And because he was a lawyer, he said, "I think this real estate question ought to get settled in the courts." Somehow or other, I think so too. But there are some very definite limitations to what courts can do, and you people have already hit on some of them. There is this lawyer's word called jurisdiction, which simply means power, which means that you can enforce it if you have to. And if you don't have jurisdiction, the United States said that the World Court of Justice did not have jurisdiction, the Nicaragua case, not a case that could be brought there and we didn't have to pay any attention to it. How will it be settled ultimately? One of these questions that plagues us today is the growing disparity in the life standard of people in the world. I'm sure you all are aware of that. I recently talked to one of my colleagues who had been doing some work in the Philippines, invited there after the last revolution to help them with a redeployment of their land. And he pointed out that the people there are able to sustain a moderate-sized family on a single acre of land a year by three crops. A single acre. They're the moderately well-to-do folks. The rest of them, of course, are much worse off. How do we resolve these problems? Well, today we take a look at the first of the five concepts, and that's the concept of justice. It's one which the Roman Catholic bishops, in their magnificent piece of work, a fine effort, let me say it that way because I don't agree with much of it, addressed the question of justice in the economy. And they come down very heavily on the idea that one way or another, the church, and indeed Christianity, and indeed our nation, that last is quite important, because they are speaking not just to the Roman Catholic Church, nor even just to Christians of the world, but they are speaking also to our government. And they are saying that law must be used to accomplish justice. Words are obviously very tricky things. Last night at the church service, we heard the story of the man beaten and robbed on the road, and the Samaritan who bound up his wounds and took him in. If there are other lawyers in the crowd, I know there's at least one, maybe you were flinching at the lack of definition all the time, too. The point of the gospel lesson, I believe, was that neighbor was being redefined. That word no longer meant, in Christ's vocabulary, the person who happens to live in the house next to you. That's the point. Who is my neighbor? Was the question. And the neighbor turns out to be someone you never saw before. A different twist to the word. Is it fair to play with words that way? Obviously, the word lawyer is nothing like what you might have thought when you heard the word lawyer. Israel had no lawyers. They had students of theology who studied the portions of the Bible that they had. The word law doesn't mean what a lawyer would think of as law. And I don't know where in the world we get away with calling the Samaritan good. Scripture doesn't. So we're constantly revising these concepts by throwing in these twists on language. Would like to have you think for a moment about the five words that I've chosen to talk about. five concepts in three columns. What the gospel might mean when it uses this concept, what the Roman Catholic bishops in the letter of the Economy seem to have meant when they were using that word, and what we might mean by that word in our everyday, ordinary, law-ridden life. Law-ridden because there are so many of us now that you can't do anything without bumping into one of us. Did you ever see the cartoon of Moses looking at God up on the top of the mountain, said, about to get the Ten Commandments, you know, and he says, you know what this means, God? There'll be lawyers all over the place. The word justice. The word justice is a very strong biblical word. And the Roman Catholic bishops use that word and the concept of justice repeatedly in their letter on the Economy. The word justice used in Scripture, the word justice used in their letter, the word justice is, of course, also used in law. This morning we'll be seeing whether or not those meanings of the word justice, the concepts, not just for point of definition, but the utility. Is it useful to think about justice? Will that help us feed more people, build more houses, provide more clothing, prevent more violence? If we clarify our thinking about how the systems work, one system or three, tomorrow we'll be talking about something which was discussed also this morning by Ruth in her Bible study, creation. What you are because of the creation. The Roman Catholic bishops call it human rights. Law calls it constitutionally protected rights. We are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. The word unalienable means you cannot alienate it. You cannot give it away and still be a human being. It doesn't mean it can't be taken from you. Obviously, anybody with a plastic bomb or a meat axe can take your life. It means that you cannot give away your life or your liberty or your freedom and be a human being. Creation, Scripture, human rights, Roman Catholic, Constitution, law. Different words, same concept. Same work and idea. The third session we'll talk about covenant. Covenant, covenant, covenant. Same word, even spelled the same way. And the references, the use, are so different they're hardly recognizable. The fourth day, authority, scriptural. Subsidiary, Roman Catholic. Lesser magistrates or family, Luther. Last, kingdom, community, institutions. Different words, same idea. It's the tension between the legal understanding and the Christian understanding. That's dangerous to us, because just as soon as you start thinking in the gospel lesson for last night, lawyer, oh, I know what that means. That means a guy like Ricky. As soon as you start thinking law, oh, I know what that means. It's the revised code of Washington or Oregon or Minnesota, wherever it happens to be. Nor can these systems be put together and work. I'm almost afraid to say this, in harness. They are exclusive of each other. What does gentle justice mean? If law operates only in violence, the threat, you know, you pay your tax or you go to jail, don't do that or we will execute you, and so forth. Whereas Christianity, the assertion I will be making to you this week, is the one system that knows no violence, no coercion, not now, not ever. God never, never, in my opinion, coerces. It is freedom. For freedom, God's made me free. If I'm right in that thought, law, violence, and gentility, Christianity, cannot meaningfully mean a combination of these things, but rather it must be that gentle justice describes Christianity and coercive requirement describes law. And that brings me to this interesting thing in the middle called the Bishop's Letter on the Economy. If at any time you have completely lost track of what I'm talking about, it is fair to say, wait a minute, and I will not be in the least bit disturbed. The bishops wrote a first draft of their letter to the economy, almost 60,000 words, in September of 1984. They wrote, as advertised, they said they would, a second draft in December of 1985. They wrote a third draft, which they released on June 4th of 1986, a copy of which I received last Friday. 45,000 words, all of which I have carefully scrutinized and memorized, and I'm in complete control of them. Well, that's because I'm a fast reader. That's why. Now, it's from these documents that we must learn what the bishops were trying to do when they bring us to the concept of justice in our living together, our economy, our sharing of wealth and housing and clothing and so forth. And I would like to start by reading a small portion of their definition of justice from the third draft. There is a copy of this, incidentally, on the wall that Bob Baker has been kind enough to put up, just a page or so if you want to read it. Are you ready? The norms of basic justice. Parenthetical, this is Riki, now not the bishops. Does justice come in sizes? Or is justice then absolute? The norms of basic justice state the minimum levels of mutual care and respect that all persons and communities owe to each other in our imperfect world. Though the rich biblical understanding of a fully just, well, there's that sizing again. You can have justice in various degrees, I guess. The rich biblical understanding of a fully just society reaches beyond these levels, the criteria, big word there, of basic justice establish the minimum standards for all social and economic life. Catholic social teaching, like much philosophical reflection, distinguishes three dimensions of basic justice: commutative justice, distributive justice, and social justice. Now about one sentence each on those. Commutative justice calls for the fundamental fairness in all agreements and exchanges between individuals or private social groups. Those of you who are mathematicians, and I'll bet there are some here, know that the notion of commutative is that you can rearrange the digits, but you've got to come out with the same sum. So if I make a deal with you and you make a deal with me, a transaction, if you are this rich when you start and I'm this rich when we get through, we're supposed to be the same. We've lost nothing. We've not taken away from each other. Distributive justice requires the allocation of income, wealth, and power in society be evaluated in light of its effects on persons whose basic material needs are unmet. And bless their dear hearts, the Roman Catholic bishops are so honest, and they are in their presentation, that they are willing to say this isn't quite a statement that the end justifies the means. But it's pretty close. Because the objective is, if a person needs more, it becomes the function of justice to see to it that person gets more. I suppose I should pause here to say that the way that's to be done is by government legislation, taxation, controlling the property, taking it from those that have, and giving it to those that do not. Not a novel idea in our society. But has it ever been done before by a statement of what is justice rather than by what is the will of the people? The Second Vatican Council stated the right to have a share of earthly goods sufficient for oneself and one's family belongs to everyone. The fathers and doctors of the church held this view, teaching that we are obliged to come to the relief of the poor and to do so not merely out of our superfluous goods. Minimum material resources are an absolute necessity for human life. If persons are to be recognized as members of the human community, then the community has the obligation to help fulfill these basic needs, unless an absolute scarcity of resources makes this strictly impossible. And is that a judgment matter or is that something else? No such scarcity exists in the United States. Well, now, at least we know that now, and I think that's probably true. Well, social justice, the third of the three. Social justice implies that persons have an obligation. I'm down hard on that word obligation, because obligation means what? Does it mean that it's enforceable? Law? Or does it mean that you really ought to do that out of conscience, but of course nobody can make you? Social justice implies that persons have an obligation to be active and productive participants in the life of society, and that society has a duty to enable. Society has a duty to enable them to participate in this way. And again, the bishops are honest enough in their approach to say that they are speaking not just to the church, but they are speaking to government as well. Well, that's interesting. We ought to talk to our government. But maybe we ought to talk to our government in the words of Aristotle, and now I pose the tension. Because Aristotle said, every lawyer in the world, in the United States at least today, I think would say, justice is a process. No person should be denied due process. That there will be rules where facts will be determined, as well as you can determine them, and there will be a body of persons who are entitled to make an application of those rules by reaching a conclusion. Not that it's right or wrong, as the United States Supreme Court says. They are not the last court because they are right. They are right because they are the last court. Lawyers, you see, say that it's only the case which has no answer that comes to law. If there is a way of determining what should be done by wrapping litmus paper around it or running it through some sort of a test or weighing it or measuring it, no one's going to hire me at $150 an hour to tell them what something weighs. I wouldn't mind. But they're going to employ me, retain me, to tell them my prediction of what a law enforcing body will do if the question comes to trial, a judgment. Lawyers do not talk about answers. Lawyers talk about judgments, opinions, decisions. Maybe the closest analogy is that funny looking fellow that stands behind the catcher in a baseball game wearing all that getup and announcing whether or not that ball that just came over was a strike or a ball. Have you ever read the law with reference to what a strike and a ball is? A strike is a thrown ball which, in the opinion of the umpire, passed within that prescribed distance. The umpire cannot be wrong. It's his opinion. And that's what it is. In this sense, in the Aristotelian sense of due process, if you've had due process, I mean, if the umpire was looking, and if he was being honest, and he gave you his best judgment, that is what it is. Whereas what you are just hearing in the third draft, the first and the second as well, of the letter, is not somebody's opinion, but it is, this is the end to be reached. Justice is made a fact, not a process. That's pretty heavy stuff, isn't it? And one has to think about it a little bit. One more sentence here. People, that's us, are summoned to be just. That is, to be in proper relation to God. Watch this one. By observing God's laws, which form them into a faithful community. The obedience of law is the way that one reaches the community, the kingdom, the salvation. Perhaps not a startling conclusion from the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church, but a little stunning for many lawyers. Can you really separate justice from law? As a law review, there is a book review written by a man by the name of McKenna, who is reviewing a book, the title of which is Justice Without Law. Justice Without Law is best characterized as a mediation on Grant Gilmore's striking aphorism from the Ages of American Law. Quote, law reflects, but in no sense determines, the moral worth of a society. It reflects, it does not determine. The values of a reasonably just society will reflect themselves in reasonably just law. The better the society, the less law there will be. In heaven, there will be no law. And now I'm going to paraphrase Ruth's Bible session again this morning. And the lion will lie down with the lamb. In hell, there will be nothing but law. And due process will be meticulously observed. Because no one will be good to anyone else, and everything will be a matter of compulsion. When in this country's history did the litigious lion ever lie down with his opponent, the lamb? Auerbach, to his clear disappointment, is able to find only a scattering of successes. A few communities managed to live together for a little while without much law. Auerbach does not hold great hopes for the growth of modern alternative dispute resolution systems. That is, justice without law, which utilize mediation and arbitration techniques unlikely to flourish. Why? Because our neighborhoods, our communities, are too weak in shared values to enforce any settlement that might be reached. Our economy has not only given us great personal freedom. You want to stop and chew on that one for just a moment? Has your wealth really made you free from fear? Our economy has not only given us great personal freedom, it has also chipped away much of the mortar that made our settlements strong and forcible in the first place. Our notion of individualism in this country, our capitalistic economy, that which says that you get to do what you want to do with your property and no one else may tell you. It says that you may pass on your wealth to your children if you like, that you may work 10 hours a day or 4 hours a day as you like, that you don't have to work if you don't want to. Freedom, in this sense, in the economy. Well, we have then kind of an interesting standoff here, and that is between the notion expressed in the letter on the economy that man is not free to make these judgments, that the law must insist that each of us, they say this in almost these words, if we had lots of time, I'd read it to you. You may borrow my copies and read it for yourself if you like. It says it is not your option to sit in the shade and loaf, that you owe your community to be productive, and that no one may be without your efforts, and this is to be done by law. Sometime when you want to think about that, turn a dime over and look at the backside of a dime and notice that thing which has got all the sticks bound together. Shall we be free, protected in our individualism from violence, although we are in love, constrained to act out our Christianity? Christianity, law, I'm able to think about those things. I'm having real trouble in the middle when I think about a biblically stated objective enforced by law. That's what bothers me about gentle justice. I offer you, not as a joke, but as another way of thinking about this, a very short two-paragraph poem written by W.H. Auden, A-U-D-E-N. This is not a joke. Law, says the priest, with a priestly look, expounding to the unpriestly people. Law is the words in my priestly book, both the Old and New Testament, I'm sure. Law is my pulpit. It is my steeple. The priest, informed by his priestly book, announces what is just. Law, says the judge, as he looks down his nose, speaking clearly, most severely, law is, as I have told you before, law is, as you know, I suppose, law is. But let me explain once more. Law is the law. One must ask the question now, when you get to this point in such a discussion, as to whether or not this concept of justice is simply a goal, an objective, something we would like to see happen. I don't suppose there's a person in the room who doesn't feel that somehow or other we ought to share the wealth which we have in this nation with other people. But as a Christian person, do you see that simply as an objective, a goal, a following after a spirit of love, freedom, letting you do what you want? The letter written by our Christian brothers, a fine piece of work, a good statement in many places, says, charity is not enough. That is a quote. It says that it is the function of government to make those determinations. It says that it is not true that the best government is that which governs least. And it says that there is a case to be made in some instances for socializing the distribution of assets. What's your feeling about that? My question really is whether or not a concept of justice can provide criteria for protection against violence. The state, of course, claims the exclusive right to use violence and to compel us to do things. Or are we simply to be subjected to somebody's notion, even 45,000 words of it, as to what justice constitutes in the economy? And that should be enacted into statutory form and given the force of positive law, meaning, of course, enforcement.
I wonder if that isn't both a little naive and also sort of a flailing of frustration. Certainly the organized church, and we are part of they and theirs, have said and have emphasized our loving attitude toward our neighbor, even a non-Christian neighbor. All people are our neighbors. And 2,000 more or less years of this have not developed a worldwide society where all people are well cared for by the wealthy sharing with those in need. And so I could visualize these good bishops saying, we can't do it within our Christian government. It doesn't have enough force, so we will turn to a secular government, tell a secular government to do for us what we have been unable to do ourselves.
We will tell you what the goal is and tell you to do it, and
yeah,
you do it.
The naivety comes in that if you be sure that you put your blinders on, so that you don't look beyond our shoulders, you can say that's an original idea. Something new this government should examine. Governments have been doing that for a number of years with maximum force, total force. They have legislated the distribution of wealth positively without exception. The fruits of that distribution have tended to be a failure. The wealthy get very wealthy, poor totally impoverished. So I think it's a share with you, the almost impossible correlation or commingling of the concept of doing out of love and doing out of force of government.
And it was said of Peter the Great's rule that the virgin with the bag of gold could ride safely from border to border without being in fear, and that's because of the immediate and swift punishment of all wrongdoing. Every village had heads strung on a rope. And I've always wondered if there was no crime anymore where the heads came from.
That question, in my feeling, needs to be asked. And I know this is written to the American society, but there are societies, even though this gentleman was saying it has not been duly enforced, I can't answer to that. I can speak from some first-hand experience living in another society where the feeling was, and I was in the Scandinavian countries, where they do have a strong legislation of what you will pay in taxes. And I was serving a parish over there with Norwegians, and completely unsolicited by me on a number of occasions, where some of my parishioners saying, we are taxed so that it will help us when we need it and help those who need it now.
Are they taxed by their own will, or are they taxed as an edict of the church?
Well, the interaction of the church and the state there, I don't know how much influence the church has in the parliamentary system, although they were part of that. That I can't answer. But I guess, and if it was the will of the people, That I can answer as well. I guess maybe they entrusted the system of living to their representatives in Parliament and went that way. Now, I don't think it is a blanket agreement throughout that whole country. All I know is what I heard from some people when they said there are 5% of the people, 90% of the populace is in the one, 5 above and 5 below. And I do know at one point reading in the paper where they had listed the 10 wealthy people in Norway and what their taxes were. And one was in the town that I was living in, and he was making 470,000 crowns a year, which was taxed 400,000. Doctors who at that point, and this was 70 to 72, doctors who were moonlighting, because they were all paid by the state, were moonlighting, were taxed 70% of their extra income. That also curtailed a lot of doctors wanting to practice medicine, which was much needed, in addition to their regular hours. But the thing that struck me was what these people said, and they prefaced it and they ended it by saying, "We have it so good." And these are not wealthy people.
Why were the doctors moonlighting?
And I think that's the question I was asking. Maybe they didn't have enough, and how much is enough?
Will a controlled economy produce as much as an uncontrolled economy, whether it's medicine or grain, or is justice and distribution rather than I'm going to make a little bit more profit a more productive process? Which of these is the more productive process? Uncontrolled. We say that, don't we? We say we are capitalists. Of course, we are only kind of capitalists. We're sort of some and some. Anybody want to make a speech about the last half a dozen years in China? You know, to go from a nation which had to import massive amounts of grain in a socialized system to one which is an exporter of grain after feeding its people in 5 years, using free enterprise in the farms, is a rather interesting phenomenon.
I think there's a great deal of difference also in China and in Norway. And I don't mean that because of the shape of the eyes. But what 1 billion people can do together, it may be somewhat representative of what 4 billion people can do together. And with what a few million people can do together can be representative of what we in the United States would say a city can do, or a state. There's an enormous difference. The commonality of feeling, and I don't try to speak for the Norwegians, they're quite capable of doing so for themselves, but must be far greater in a, I don't mean a small geographic country, but a country with a relatively fewer number of people, extremely homogeneous, not exclusively homogeneous. That is not very representative of the rest of the world that I see, but really unique.
What's your impression, ladies and gentlemen, about the two basic notions, interpretations of the word justice? That is, Aristotle's notion, rejected here, that justice really is a process. You know, the word justice itself comes from joust. Two people on horses running at each other with spears and going bang, jousting, trial by combat. We've been talking a little bit about the Scandinavians. They were the masters of it. In the earliest form of law, if you wanted to find out whether a person had committed a crime or not, one way of doing it was to have him pick up a hot iron. If he burned, he was guilty. If he wasn't, why, that's an indication of innocence. God was protecting him. Or another system was to bind him with weights, and tie his hands and feet with a rope, and chuck him in the nearest fjord. If he sunk, he was guilty. If not, why, God was holding him up. Later, it was discovered that the devil was messing up the court system by holding up guilty people, and so they gave that one up. But the basic notion of trial by representation, by advocacy, by process, by rules, a contest where the result, if done according to the rules of the trial, was just, even if wrong. I think now, baseball umpire, you can't be wrong. If you don't know what's right or wrong, and you've gone through a process which is the best one that you have, the one that you've agreed to, and you come out with the result, it's got to be right by definition. You know, there is no right or wrong in law. It's a process. That's Aristotle, Aristotelian thinking here, comparing that with what the Roman bishops in this very concern, I hope I'm not sounding negative about, I admire them for having given us a statement on social justice, which shows so much sensitivity to the needs of people and cries out for some kind of redistribution of assets and wealth and food, social justice, attributive justice, commutative justice, all of that. You know, my system says, I admire this. And then they say, and this is the way it's to be done. This is justice, now accomplish that goal. How? Is it self-defining? They have an interesting quote in here that says, justice is equality. Is justice equality? Shall there be differences in some people having more to eat than other folks? Or shall we really commit ourselves to the notion that justice is equality? You've had your 2,000 calories for today. That's all you get.
I guess for me it goes back to the statements that you made earlier that heaven is a world without law and hell is a law-ridden world.
Lots of due process.
Yeah, lots of due process, but... And trying to reconcile that idea, which really rings true to me in my own experience of just how it feels to live in a different setting.
You're listening to an assistant attorney general of the state of Washington.
Oh, dear. I don't think I want to say anymore.
Oh, you're doing fine.
No, but what I meant was, or what I wanted to question is, I don't know how to get... And I don't see that it's possible to get from defining an end result and dictating a way, or any way, for others to get there, other than for yourself, without losing personal freedom and imposing rules which don't feel good.
And maybe don't work.
And through, yeah, cannot work. In the largest sense of the word. And in reading somewhat about Gandhi and re-watching the movie about Gandhi, that hit me very, very strongly, that somehow he was able to never compromise his own beliefs of what is right, what is love, to the other people that he was working with, which seemed to be a bit more pragmatic in, well, we need to do it this way to get there. And he would say, no, that's not loving.
Are we better off to live in a society which permits us to try and express our love in the way that we see it, even though we express it quite imperfectly? Or are we better off in a society which has attempted to define love and justice and insists that we adhere to the definition? Yes, sir.
I
Well, it seemed like communism is a case in point where they've attempted to redistribute the wealth and so forth, and they have uniformity. And it seems kind of an anachronism that there the religion is subverted. And is this the utopia that we're striving for? Is that what the bishops had in mind?
I wonder. Now they say there is a case to be made for the socialization of some of the economy in the nation. They also emphasize that they're for a free economy. And I find myself looking on both sides immediately there. But, all right, so we always have to make adjustments, you know, some and some. But that calls for some kind of a process. And the process has to have its own concepts of what's fair and unfair, and we must be willing to take the results of the due process. That's Aristotle's argument. Rather than saying that, look, it's impossible for us to say that this was God's rule, this is God's law, and you've got to abide. The one sentence that I read for you is you attain the community, the kingdom of God, by observance of the law. You want to hear it again? People are summoned to be just, that is, to be in a proper relation to God, by observing God's laws, which form them into a faithful community. Well, we started out, you remember, by saying neighbor doesn't mean neighbor. There and here, scripture and common law. Lawyer certainly doesn't mean lawyer, and law doesn't mean law. What is the meaning of that sentence? By observing God's laws. Yes,
sir. Well, you promised you would thoroughly scramble our brains. And I guess what I'm hearing, Vern, is kind of a dichotomy in your thinking with regard to the application of Christian principle, teaching, and value to the social and governmental political orders. And I hear you saying that God's justice then is totally different from man's justice. That we cannot apply, therefore, the principles of God's justice to the human order and to the human community. But the question comes up in my mind, is not God also in the process with us? And cannot God's relationship to the human community also be defined as a process? And have there not been steps of development, so to speak, in that process of God's dealing with the human community? And could not a social distributive order, such as a modified form of capitalism, be applicable in the present time, without calling it something that God has imposed or ordained upon us, but we have been led to this point out of a understanding of God's process of dealing with this. I don't want to make the dichotomy quite as sharp as you seem to want to make it.
Very, very good, provocative statement. That is, after all, the question, isn't it? And I caution you that for those of you who have a stomach for such things, I will do the same thing with human rights, Constitution, and with covenant, and so forth. Because that is that line which separates the legal from the Christian. How closely can we harness those things together? Do you accept, even in your own thinking, the dichotomy which I do make? And that is, when I say legal, I mean violence. Oh, hopefully not always. Hopefully the law is the teacher also. And it's not necessary to have the policeman at every stoplight to see that I stop on red and go on green. But it doesn't hurt to have some publicity about the fact that you get picked up if you do it the wrong way. There's always the threat of violence there in order to make legal work. While the other part of that for me is there really such a thing as a Christian feeling constrained by the love which God has shared with us, and that we in turn share with others, so that we can use the tools which God gave us to work. Law is nothing but a tool. For me, there is nothing sacred about law. When the people who were no people came out of Egypt, they were given law in order to survive. And here I would borrow the words of the Roman Catholic letter here, at a minimum level, law for me is truly God's poverty plan for human beings. When you cannot survive in community, when we cannot survive out of the love for other people, when we cannot respond to God's affirmation, so that we don't understand justice as gentle justice, but we try to bring justice to fruition by law, then I have a great difficulty, because for me there is that dichotomy. Maybe I make it too sharply, you may very well be right. If I can think of law as being the same as a shovel, it's a way of accomplishing a task, and if my own thinking about what I would like to see in the world can be implemented by the use of rules and by process, then that's a very handy tool. But if one elevates justice to an absolute quality and pretends that it's knowable, and then define it and now say it has stopped being process and has become end, then I'm afraid the end does, the definition of end, does justify means. And it is not at all clear to me that God did not intend differences in human beings of a very real order. Yes, sir?
Continuing the attack on the dichotomy for a moment, you do seem to be think very much like a lawyer, understandably, and the dichotomy, stated another way, it seems to me that you're constantly working with, is the individual and the state. The bishops, not surprisingly, think like bishops, and they are thinking like heads of a community, which is more than an individual and less than a state, or maybe something else besides the state. It's a set of intermediary institutions, as a sociologist would say. For them, it seems to me, thinking about morals and values, mores and values, is the equivalent of thinking for you about laws and rules. Right? So when they're talking about putting some content into justice, filling up what seems to me some of the aridity, the dryness of procedural view of justice that you have naturally as a lawyer, they're talking really, I think, about engendering the values of a community whose definition comes not from the state, but from a shared faith. And it's not surprising also that the Catholics have a better sense of their community than most of the Protestants. So I think one other way is to go after the dichotomy, and I do think that, I mean, for my taste, it's too separated, is to think about these intermediary institutions. What do we as a Christian community think about the values of justice? Is it enough for us to say that justice is just procedural? Or do we need to put some content into that? Does our faith in some way obligate us in the Christian community, not under the state, to put some content into justice?
What do we mean, if we mean anything, when we say, I am compelled by the love of God? Does that mean that I am to be punished if I fail? Could we agree that God never punishes? I'm going to insist on that this week. You're quite welcome to disagree with me. We have time for about one more shot, and then we got to quit.
Is it possible that the path that the bishop's letter is taking, and I'm only familiar with it from what you've shared with us today, is trying to basically say that for the Christian, it's not enough to say that if we play by the rules, that's all that's required of us? That it takes...
No.
We are required also to look at the net result, the end product, the fruits or whatever. Going back to your analogy of the umpire, the opinion of the umpire determines whether due process is, or if due process is followed, if the umpire calls it one way or the other, that's it. If justice is just, is only due process, and as long as we have followed the rules, we can feel good about what's happening. And perhaps all we're being asked to do by the dichotomy that the bishops hold before us is to say that that's, maybe that's not enough. That if we have followed due process and things are so unequally distributed in terms of basic necessities for people that most can recognize that there's an inequity there, maybe if nothing else, the due process has to be looked at. Or the criteria in that due process, or the rules by which we have agreed to play as a society, maybe those need to be looked at, because I can't claim to be in the right just by saying I followed all the rules. When the net result itself is not fair, then maybe we need to go back and at least have a dialogue between a notion of justice and the process by which we agree to live.
That's what we've got to talk about. And we obviously have a flowing conversation here. Tomorrow, for those of you who like to play, we pick up on this idea. We'll be looking at two cases, both by the United States Supreme Court rather recently. Both stated rather simply, but terribly important. One of them involves a Jew, a psychologist in the military, who believes that it is spiritual obligation to wear a cover on his head at all times. And he is told by the army that he is out of uniform and must take that thing off his head. And it goes to the United States Supreme Court. How would you decide? The other case is a case of a young man who happens to be here in the state of Washington, a man named Witter, who had a disability and he could not see so well. Washington has a program that says people with a disability are entitled to public funds to help them get an education to become productive in trade. He claimed his right for contribution from the state for such help. The state asked him, said, certainly you meet the criteria, you've got the disability, we will help you. What is it that you want to do? Let us help you. And he said, I want to go to school in order to become a pastor. And they said, well, of course, we cannot do that. You want to be a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, or even a lawyer. But a pastor? Oh, no, of course not.